Mackenzie Valley Pipeline, which caused a certain amount of disagreement between the two organizations. And in fact, the Métis Association, to some extent, supported the construction of the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline. And because of that, there developed a very serious rift between the Métis Association and the Dene Nation. And that is historical fact. I was president of the association at that time. In fact, my tenure practically coincided with Mr. Justice Berger's commission in the territories. Okay, and as a result of that, as Bill explained, the Government of Canada had taken the position that they would accept a claims proposal from the two groups, and in fact, in 1977, the Métis Association submitted a comprehensive claims proposal to the Government of Canada, and that proposal was accepted by the Government of Canada for negotiations. And basically, Bill has explained what has happened since then with the change in the shift in policy by the government, and what is finally happened in the Northwest Territories. We are back together working on a joint basis, trying to establish a single claim in the valley. It was in the fall of 1983 our two organizations established what is now called the Dene-Métis Joint Negotiations Secretariat. And that secretariat is working on behalf of both organizations. And I just might note that it's the current terminology these days is now Dene-Métis. And but that is the fact that we have established this joint working relationship is probably a good first step, but certainly we still are faced with a unique challenge in the Mackenzie Valley of trying to accommodate the aspirations of the two groups. And I believe it's possible, and based on our past experience of the difficulties between the two organizations, I think that we now know that we have to get along together, and we are in fact accommodating to each other much more so than has been in the case in the past. This is probably evidenced by, first of all, we as a Métis Association, I believe it was in 1980, adopted what we call the Métis Declaration, which in essence said that through the land claims process, it was our desire that this process would lead to our recognition as Métis people. And this declaration has been adopted by the Dene Nation. And so that has certainly helped bring the two groups closer together. And the other thing that has made a stronger case for the Métis is, in fact, the Canadian Constitution, which now recognizes them as a distinct Aboriginal group in Canada. So that's basically the history of our situation with the Métis and the Northwest Territories. But before I go on, pass the mic over to Steve Iverson, I'd like to perhaps touch on some current issues, some of the questions that have been raised here, and just generally talk about some of the ideas that the Métis have for the comprehensive claims package. And what I'm going to talk about fits in with the context of some of the questions that have been going on here, the question of corporate structures and so forth. But I don't want anybody to be misled and think that the Métis total concentration is on corporate structures. In fact, I would say that our position would be that before we start to negotiate corporate structures, titled lands, or cash compensation, It is our position that the whole question of hunting, fishing, and trapping rights must be firmly identified before we move on to the other areas. And the question of hunting, fishing, and trapping rights is something that is probably dear to the Métis people in the Northwest Territories. As I mentioned earlier, we tend to be a bit individualistic, but if there's one thing that pulls us together, it is that question. In fact, about 10 years ago, the Legislative Assembly of the Northwest Territories made some attempts to remove our system of general hunting licenses, and that was certainly a unifying force at that time, and the Legislative Assembly certainly heard from us about it. And that was before your time, Dennis. We, although we do not have a comprehensive package together as yet, and therefore we don't have a claims agreement with Canada, we have been, since we established what we call the Métis Development Corporation Limited in 1977, and since that time we have been working on developing its corporate structure, and so we have had 7 years to work different models, and it is our hope that certainly any monetary benefits Métis people may receive from that claim will be channeled through our existing Métis Development Corporation. And I found it quite interesting that listening to Mark Gordon yesterday, some of the ideas that we have developed in isolation of what they've done in James Bay, in fact, is very similar to what they have done there. And we've managed to avoid a couple of the problems that you've got here in Alaska with your corporate structures. One of them is the issue of share alienation. The way we have established the corporation is that each member of our organization is entitled to purchase one share in that corporation, and it is his or hers for their life. And when they die, that share reverts to the corporation. And it cannot be sold or pledged or bargained or anything. It's yours. It's your share in a Métis Development Corporation. And the issue of the afterborn, the way we structured it is that anyone that is a member of our organization, once they reach the age of majority, are entitled to purchase their one share. So there's no cutoff, and there's no possibility of the shares being pulled into the hands of one person. All we can do is own one, and then when we die, it's no longer ours. Those shares that are held by the individuals are non-voting shares in the corporation. The only two rights they carry is the right to dividends and the right to share in the assets of the corporation if we ever wind it up. Now, the voting shares in the corporation are in the hands of our local organizations. The Métis Association itself is comprised of 11 local organizations, and each of those, once they have become a body corporate, are entitled to purchase one Class A share. And it is only those Class A shares that carry any voting rights in the corporation. So each of our locals would have one vote in it. And we are working on some changes right now, and the board of directors will be established in such a way that there will not be an election for a board. Each Class A shareholder, that is the locals, will appoint one person to the board of directors. And that is the structure that we currently have in place. Other issue that has been raised here, and I imagine we probably will get into a bit more during the question period, but is this whole question of status, non-status. And it is a problem for us not only in Canada, but particularly in the Northwest Territories. You know, my personal view is that eventually the issue should disappear in the Northwest Territories, and what we will have are Dene people and Métis people, not status or non-status. And I wish that were the situation today, but unfortunately, because of the way things have happened historically, we still have a fair number of people that cling to this thing called non-status. And but the other future problem, though, is that even after the settlement is in place, we are going to have Aboriginal people living in the Northwest Territories that will not be participating in the benefits of the settlement with Canada. Native people in Canada tend to be mobile, and I don't have an exact figure, but there are a number of Native people from southern Canada that have moved into the Northwest Territories, and right now it is unclear as to how many of those would be allowed to participate in the benefits of the settlement. There's one school of thought that says it should be restricted to only those people that participated in the treaties and the half-breed commissions in 1921. And there's another school of thought that would like to expand that formula to include people that moved from other parts of Canada. And we are currently in the process of trying to resolve that question.
You mean that the people who would participate would be those who could trace their ancestry to the people who signed the treaties and were represented at the half-breed commissions in 1921?
That's basically it, yes. Now, the only other comment I would like to make at this time is I would like to acknowledge a certain feeling of indebtedness that I have for other Native people, particularly in Alaska. And, you know, it's unfortunate you're having the problems that you're having now, but you know, I must say that, you know, had you not gone through the experience that you have, we may not be in the situation that we are in the Northwest Territories. We certainly are learning from some of the mistakes that you've made here, and you know, again, as I say, it's a rather unfortunate situation. We certainly owe, you know, a debt of gratitude to you here.
Thank you, Rick. Steve Iverson.
My name is Steve Iverson, and I'm a staff person with the Western Constitutional Forum. I'll talk a bit more about the forum itself, its makeup and mandate later, but I thought a bit of demographic information might be useful for this discussion as well, for those not familiar with the Northwest Territories. Sure. Historically, the Northwest Territories has been that part of Canada that has not become part of Confederation by being included as a province in Confederation. And as Mark Gordon mentioned yesterday, Northern Quebec was part of the Northwest Territories before 1912, for instance. The current Northwest Territories really came into existence north of 60, not including Northern Quebec and Northern Ontario, in 1905 when Saskatchewan and Alberta were created as provinces. However, the colonial administration, the government for that region, continued to stay in Ottawa until 1967. So it gives you a bit of a sense of where power lay and how far that aspect of government, at least, was from the people who were being governed. Although it's not clear how much impact in those early years that government actually had on people's lives in the Northwest Territories. It was somewhat irrelevant in many respects. Currently, the Northwest Territories is approximately 1.3 million square miles of land, with a lot of seawater between the Arctic Islands as well and in the Hudson's Bay. The population is, and these figures aren't cast in stone, they're rough, it's approximately 47,000 people in the NWT. Of those, roughly 8,500 would be status Dene. Roughly 4,000 would be Métis and non-status. Approximately 16,500 would be Inuit. That's for a total population of 29,000 Native people or Aboriginal people in the NWT, leaving approximately 18,000 non-natives in the north. Now, these figures may be out by 1,000 here and there, but that gives you a rough picture. I think that's fairly accurate. Now, with that non-native population, the vast majority are in the western half of the Northwest Territories, perhaps as much as 90% of it. Having done that, now perhaps I can talk a bit about the Western Forum and how it came into existence, the reasons behind it. As is obvious, the government which was created, the colonial government, was largely an imposed system, and it was colonial in the extreme originally, stayed in Ottawa, no elected persons from the north participating in it, and imposing its will on whatever jurisdictions it actually had on the north from there. Over the years, it's changed, and it's changed quite dramatically in the last few years. Now, of course, it's in Yellowknife, is the capital. There is a legislative assembly of 24 members who are all elected. And the membership itself in the assembly is fairly representative of the Northwest Territories in terms of how it breaks down, both regionally, obviously, and by Aboriginal background or non-Aboriginal background as well. However, there was a sense, and certainly during the 70s, it was very much true that the government of the Northwest Territories was very much the government of the non-native population. Primarily, that's how it was perceived. You had not been accepted by the Inuit or the Dene and Métis as their own government. It hadn't sprung up from their own history. It had been imposed, and there was a sense of alienation from it, both for where it came from, how it operated, what it represented, and so on. And particularly during the mid and late 70s, when there was a lot of struggle going along, particularly in the Western Territories over the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline, for instance, the Legislative Assembly at that time was much more dominated by non-Native people and was seen as more of a tool of that particular group to try to represent its interests, whereas the Native associations were representing the views of Native people, of Aboriginal people. It's already been pointed out how the political element or the attempt to negotiate political self-government through the claims process has largely been denied one way or the other by the federal government. Each Aboriginal group in the north, and there are three groups who are attempting to negotiate claims, has tried at one point or the other to build in political development as a major component in their claims process. And in all cases, that has been denied. With some modifications, of course. There is participation in boards of management, which you could call political to a certain degree, and there is, as Bill mentioned, some talk about some political conditions that might be in a claim at the local level, community level, with band councils or whatever. But by and large, political issues were denied as part of the process. And I think a good deal of the
boards of management relating to fish and game?
Yes, things like that, and land use, perhaps.
Sorry.
When the Ninth Assembly came into being in 1979, they created a unity committee of MLAs who toured the North to get the views of people in all communities as to how they did perceive the government of the Northwest Territories.
Excuse me, Steve, you mean the Legislative Assembly?
Legislative Assembly, yes, sorry. And In very brief summary, by and large, the reaction they found was that most of the Aboriginal peoples in their communities did not perceive this current government as its legitimate government. They saw it as an interim government, and obviously as the vehicle that controlled a lot of funds and had a lot of power, and therefore was a very important part of their lives. But the current government they saw as an interim administration until they'd had the opportunity to negotiate a change, something new, a government which they felt actually reflected their values and aspirations. As a result of that, the Constitutional Alliance of the Northwest Territories was formed, and that was made up with representatives of all the major political Aboriginal associations in the Northwest Territories and the Legislative Assembly. It included the presidents of the Inuit-Tapirisat, of COPE, of the Dene Nation, of the Métis Association, and four MLAs. Now, two MLAs from the east and two MLAs from the west.
MLAs are members of the Legislative Assembly.
Right. Is that missing in action? Now, one important element of that was that at least two of the MLAs were chosen on the basis to represent the non-native population in their area, particularly in the West, where that was most relevant. One of the conditions for that alliance being formed was that it support the holding of a plebiscite in the Northwest Territories regarding the issue of division of the Northwest Territories into two political jurisdictions. That vote went ahead in April of 82. The vote was roughly 56.5% in favor of division, 43.5% in opposition to division. Geographically, the Northwest Territories, if you were trying to split it down the middle in half, the community of Cambridge Bay would kind of be on a line. And the voting patterns based on that line were that the people east of Cambridge Bay, primarily, well, all Inuit communities with a couple of government centers that had non-native population as well, the voter turnout was extremely high, and the support for division was very high as well, something in the range of 85%, I believe. The voting patterns from Cambridge Bay West were quite different. The voter turnout was generally much lower, and the overall vote in the West was actually against division. And that represents something, I think it's a feeling that still exists today, and I'll talk perhaps a bit more about that later on.
Sorry to interrupt again, but in the eastern half of the Northwest Territories, the population is predominantly Inuit. And they voted in very large numbers by a massive majority to divide so that they would have their own political jurisdiction. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, that's right. In the West, the population from Cambridge Bay West, the population is a rich mixture of Inuit, Inuvialuit, Dene, Métis, and non-native people. And actually, the Inuit from Cambridge Bay West actually voted against division because they saw themselves torn in two directions, I suppose. The Dene voted marginally in favor of division. The non-native population that voted overwhelmingly against division. This is just, you're talking about, we won't get into what form the governments are going to take right now. You're just talking about dividing, we'll say at this point, one form of government into two, cloning it, let's say. That's not what our group is arguing about actually forming. Each group is talking about creating new governments. But division per se is simply the creation of two political jurisdictions with, you could say, the same form of governance already exists for one, only hopefully more accessible. It's not such a big area to deal with.
Could I answer Charlie's question? In the eastern half of the Northwest Territories, if you divide it, it would be predominantly Inuit on an ethnic basis with a small minority of whites. In the western side, it would be, as far as the Aboriginal populations are concerned, predominantly Dene and Métis with a small population of Inuit and a population of whites that would be quite large. I think that's about right, isn't it?
Yes, if division took place, you would actually find that the non-native population and the Aboriginal population would be just about even, or in fact, the non-native population might actually become a majority right off the bat once division occurs.
On the west side?
On the west side, and that's a very important issue, of course. With the results then of the plebiscite, the Legislative Assembly then passed a motion recognizing the plebiscite and giving unanimous support to division in principle. And the Constitutional Alliance decided that since they were talking about the creation of two new governments, one in the East and one in the West, they really should divide themselves into two forums so that the Eastern group could look at government for an Eastern territory and the Western group could look at a government for a Western territory. Well, initially, both sides aspire to becoming provinces down the road. Neither side expects to become a province immediately after division and see it more as a staged approach and a long-term goal with some roadblocks in the ways in the way and steps to be taken to reach there, not one leap. Does that answer your question?
No.
That is the political reality, I think, of what is going to occur. If you want to, both forums, the Constitutional Alliance and its negotiations with the Minister of Indian Affairs and other ministers to have its mandate recognized and affirmed by the federal government, stressed the fact that it was not simply looking at restructuring government within the North and altering relationships within the North. It was also very much looking at how it would renegotiate its relationship with the federal government to the end of having much more power and authority in the NWT in a similar sense, if not the same, as other provinces have in Canada. The federal government's response was to attempt to argue that the restructuring of the government and the establishment of governments on each new territory was not part and parcel with the creation of provinces in the two territories. And we differ on that, of course.
This would not wipe out DNA.
No, it won't immediately. Other actions taking place in Ottawa might. The Pena report may get rid of Indian Affairs before division of the NWT does.
But just Sheldon, you might share that microphone with Charlie, but maybe we could just hold the questions because Steve Cacfui will follow and talk about kind of government they want to establish, and then Dennis Patterson and Peter Atinwar will talk about what they want to do in the Eastern Arctic. Peter, you wanted to interrupt here?
Very briefly, Mr. Chairman, our presentation is in two parts. I will give an introduction, and with me are Mr. Randy Ames, a senior negotiator for Tungavik, Mr. Dennis Patterson, chairman of the NCF, both of which are under the umbrella or parent organization ITC. So just to clarify.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to that. Okay. Well, carry on, Steve.
Okay. Just a comment again on the makeup then of the forums. The Nunavut Forum, which Dennis and Peter will talk about, includes Dennis as Minister of Aboriginal Rights and Constitutional Development. Includes Elijah Urklu, another MLA from the Eastern Arctic. It includes Bob Cadlin of the TFN, the Inuit Claims Organization, John Amagwalik, President of ITC, and Peter Atinwar, Member of Parliament for the Eastern Arctic for the Nunatsiaq riding, and Peter Green of COPE. All right. The Western Constitutional Forum includes Steve Cacfui for the Dene Nation, Larry Taranjo, President of the Métis Association, Nick Sibiston, Associate Minister of Aboriginal Rights and Constitutional Development, and Bob McQuarrie, a MLA from Yellowknife, whose job it is to represent the non-native population in the Western NWT in these negotiations. The people of COPE have the doors open for them to participate in both forums, since where their area may end up after division takes place is not clear. They, to date, have chosen to work with Nunavut Constitutional Forum, and that's how things stand at this point in time. The I guess one of the most interesting things is the fact itself, the creation of those forums, is that instead of the Legislative Assembly as the government of the Northwest Territories, taking on, seeing itself as having the responsibility for constitutional development, it has been acknowledged that that simply is not the case. They do not have that singular responsibility for constitutional development. And the makeup of the organization is that the Aboriginal organizations and the assembly members on the forum operate as equals. Decisions are reached on a consensus basis. Each party has a veto, and any decision that might be put forth or any suggestion put forth. And that is of critical importance in the structure of the forum. Its very existence is important and unique. I should also point out that any decisions reached by the forum are only tentative. They're not official until they've actually been ratified by the public in one form or another. Final ratified proposals then would go to the federal government for negotiation. Now, the mandate of the Western Forum is basically to deal with all issues related to the creation of a new constitution for a Western political jurisdiction. Tied very much into this is the issue of Aboriginal self-government and what that can mean in a public government jurisdiction. Now, by public government jurisdiction, I mean in a region where, instead of by virtue of the southern system of the treaties that operated there and the Indian Act, there were reserves created, and the political structure, at least, is one of separate development. Rather, the price of separate development in the Northwest Territories may be far too high, and in effect, it means cutting oneself off from a large portion of the Northwest Territories if one opts for that route. And that at this point, at least, Aboriginal associations are looking at ways and means whereby their distinct interests and their future as collectives, as peoples, can be protected and enhanced in a public government system. Some of the issues that relate to that then are the style and structure of government, how decisions are made, who makes them, what the recognition of, again, collectives in governments, and not simply the matter of recognition of individual rights vis-a-vis a central authority, how that becomes reflected in the government system itself, looking at redistribution of powers to regional and local levels in such ways that at that area, at that more local level, where many of the differences between groups show up most highly, people are allowed, to set up government structures and ways of making decisions that are different from one area to the other, so that Yellowknife's view of local government is not imposed upon Fort Norman's and vice versa. And looking at concurrent power, sharing of power between local and regional councils and the more central level of government as well, so the region gets heard and the local area gets heard. And also looking at what rights are exclusive to Aboriginal people by virtue of who they are as Aboriginal rights, and how that gets reflected in a public government system as well. Now, obviously, the claims process ties in very much to this. The two go hand in hand to a certain degree. Those things defined in the claims process are exclusive by definition, and the constitutional development cannot override anything that's in that. But above and beyond is the potential to establish principles of Aboriginal self-government in a public government jurisdiction, which can be entrenched and protected as well in the long run. That's what we're talking about here. Language issues are important as well, of course. Maybe the final thing I'll say is that sets the major task then of the Western Forum, as it is for the Nunavut Forum, is the establishment of a new constitution for their territory. Together, the Western and Nunavut Forum still come together as the Constitutional Alliance to discuss the selection of a boundary for division. as always, a difficult issue, but one that we're going to be addressing seriously later on this month, and I'm optimistic that things will go very well. And I think I'll stop that there then, and Steve can speak from there.
Steve Kekwe.
Okay. What I will do is try to give an overview, perhaps take the areas that the three earlier speakers addressed, and try to tie them into a general picture that hopefully if I spend enough time at you might be able to see what it is that we are doing in the different areas that were mentioned and how they fit together to, in the future, the Dene and the Métis will have some measure of control and power to exercise their rights as people. There is at the national level now in Canada political discussions being held between the provinces and the federal government, the two jurisdictions that are recognized presently in the Canadian Constitution. A couple of years ago, the Aboriginal people, the Métis, the Inuit, the Treaty Indians of Canada, got agreement with, a political agreement with the provinces and the federal government to hold a series of four constitutional conferences that would be directed at trying to identify and defining the Aboriginal rights, defining what Aboriginal rights are. There has been two conferences now, and they have been largely of benefit only to the general public in trying to get the message of Aboriginal people across to Canadians through the national TV coverage that we received. There are the general objective of the Aboriginal people together, in spite of the differences that they have, is that they want the Aboriginal rights of people to be recognized and entrenched in the Canadian Constitution. They want the right of Aboriginal people to self-government to be recognized and entrenched in the Constitution. And for some, such as the Métis people, they have very strong feelings about wanting the governments to agree they should have a land base and then to help them acquire a land base, because a large portion of the Métis people in Canada do not presently have a land base and are not recognized as people that are responsibilities of either the federal government or the provinces. The other objective of the Aboriginal groups, which is very emotional, I think it was mentioned yesterday, was equality. It took up quite a lot of the two-day conference, the attention and the time that was held by this item was quite significant. Simply, in Canada, there is one aspect of equality which is very emotional for women, and it was mentioned yesterday. If a treaty woman marries outside of anyone other than treaty, she automatically becomes in the federal government's eyes, other, that is, not a responsibility any longer, no longer having any Aboriginal rights. On the other hand, a man who is treaty can marry anyone from any part of the world, and that person will become legally, in the government's eyes, an Aboriginal person, that is, a person with full legal treaty rights. And this has been an ongoing controversy for years. I think there is agreement amongst the organizations that yes, it's unfair, it's unjust, and it should be addressed, but not because the federal government wants it addressed, and it's definitely not their prerogative. That it's the prerogative of the different nations of people in Canada to define their own membership. That is, it is a right of a self-governing nation, a nation of people within the state of Canada that wants to retain a degree of sovereignty to define its own membership. That it's inherent in any people that wish to retain a degree of sovereignty. The other aspect to the issue of equality is the equality of all Aboriginal people in the eyes of the law, in the eyes of the Constitution. That is, presently, the only people that have that are sort of trustees or protected by the federal government of Canada are the treaty and the Inuit, but specifically the treaty people. The Métis are not given the same treatment, are not extended the same privileges, the same rights, benefits. And so equality goes beyond just the issue of how women should be treated in relation to men, but how all Aboriginal people in Canada should be treated and respected and recognized. And the feeling is, at least from the Dene Nation, that the Inuit, the Métis, the non-status Indians, and the treaty should all eventually end up with the same degree of rights, the same recognition in the Canadian Constitution, and that at the different regions of Canada, the variations that are required because of the differences between the native peoples, their traditions, their values, will be reflected there. But at the national level, equal rights for all Aboriginal people is an objective, at least, of the Dene Nation. I think most of the other Aboriginal groups in Canada take the same position. The significance of what is happening at the national level for myself as a leader of the Dene Nation is that it appears very difficult at the present time to convince the provinces that and the federal government to agree with the objectives and the ideas that we want them to accept. We also have a difficulty between the national Native organizations in agreeing on how to work together and what the agenda should be and how they should approach these constitutional discussions. There is a history of differences, certainly between the provinces and the federal government. There's a long history of differences, it's been referred to by different speakers, between the Inuit and the Indian people of Canada. And I think there's differences between the Métis and the Indians. And they're cultural, they're historical, they're very real. But at the same time, it seems at the expense of our community membership, the differences seem to prevail at the constitutional discussions, and we walk away, at least from the last constitutional conference, not having accomplished anything simply because we did not work together. And the reason I say it's significant to me is because in the Northwest Territories, at least in the western part of the Northwest Territories, what we have is an opportunity to show Canada at the national level how it could be done, how we can get a government, as it is called, the NWT government, to work with the Aboriginal people, how the Treaty Dene can work with the Métis population, how the non-treaty Dene can work with the Métis, how the Inuit that are going to be in the western part of the territory can work with us, and how we can, as Aboriginal people of that part of the territory, can work together and establish a relationship with the non-native people of that part of the territory and come up with an agreement on how we're going to govern ourselves. And that is, I think, a challenge that we have, an opportunity. What has been mentioned before, earlier by a number of speakers, again, the Dene Nation has been pushing for recognition of their right to self-government for about 10, 15 years now. These things are starting to happen. We also have been pushing for years for the constitutional redesign of Canada. That is happening. The redesign of the government, or the make of a government for the Dene and for the western part of the Northwest Territories, is also in the making. And it has been mentioned earlier, but the Dene have always insisted that we have all the rights of a nation, although we have, by no choice of ours,